We continue the life and times of Judge Jephthah tonight. We're in Judges chapter 11. We will start covering new ground at verse 32, but I'm going to have us back up and and read also verses 30 and 31 so that we can take this complete story in one session. Once we get reading here, you'll remember real quick where we left off. Let's read in verse 30. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will give the Ammonites into my hand," verse 31, "then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." Okay, yeah, now we all remember where we left off. We left off with Jephthah's vow. Anchored, I know we've talked about this a lot, but they just keep coming up in our Old Testament studies, and here we are again. So I'll say it again. There never really is a single good reason to make a vow before the Lord. The Lord takes vows very seriously. And as always, I would point you to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, verses 4 and 5, where King Solomon says, "When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay." And so there you have it. The man known for his unparalleled wisdom and all of the history of the world has just told you that you are better off not making a vow before the Lord at all. I would just add that they are completely unnecessary. Here's a question that wisdom would ask. Why do you have to vow to do something? A vow is a promise to the Lord that you're going to do it. Why do you have to promise that you're going to do something? Can't you just do it? If you make a vow, this is the issue, you know. If you make a vow, you have guaranteed the Lord that you are going to do that thing, whatever it is. So you are on the hook. And if something should come up in life, which is very common because we're human beings and life gets chaotic, and something comes up and knocks you off of your quest and you don't fulfill your vow, now you have committed a sin before the Lord. You've broken, something was different there, huh? We forgot to turn those on. You've broken your word to the Lord. So how much better it would be to just to decide to do something. Usually a vow is some expression, something that you're going to carry out to show the Lord your gratitude or to bless the Lord's heart. So wouldn't it be so much better if you just decided to do that thing to bless the Lord and you didn't promise Him that you were going to do it? You just made the decision. And then that way, if something does come up in life, then, hey, no sweat. You didn't offend the Lord in any way. You didn't sin against Him. All that you managed to do was fail to live up to your own expectation, your own decision. And that's really not a problem. This is why I never promise to do anything on the honey-do list. Never promise. I decide to do it, and then that way when I don't get around to doing it, I don't feel bad. Now, if I promise, if I make that vow, yeah, honey, I'll get that porch all fixed up before the end of the week. Well, now we know I'm going to let her down. I'm going to fail that vow. I'm going to break that vow. Now, it seems like this should be obvious, that this is just the way to go. Don't vow. Just decide to do it and then go do it. But so many people do this still to this day in the New Testament. So many people make vows before the Lord. And there actually is a reason why people do this. It's not a good reason, but there is a reason. And I'm going to expose that right now, in hopes that I can forever set you free of the temptation of making a vow before the Lord. The reason that a person makes a vow to the Lord is so that they can get credit now in advance of actually doing the thing that they're vowing to do. Do you realize that's why we make vows? Now, the reason that we want the credit for carrying out the vow before we carry it out, that can be kind of twofold. Usually it's for one of two reasons. Number one, we just want to bless the Lord big right now. Like, we're just moved in our hearts and our souls and our spirits. And we want to bless the Lord in a big way right now. So we say, Lord, I'm just so blessed by you, and I want to bless you. Here's what I vow to do. So we're wanting to bless him in that moment by giving him the promise. We're wanting the credit for it as if it's done in advance of actually doing it. Now, the other reason that we do it is an even more negative reason. We make a vow. We want the credit for that vow up front. And the reason for that is because we want to leverage that in our bargaining with the Lord. That's exactly what Jephthah has done here. Jephthah is trying to sweeten the pot with the Lord. He's trying to say, Lord, if you'll do this, then here's what I'm going to do. So give me that credit up front. You know, I'm committing this to you. Give me the credit now. And let me use that as a bargaining chip between you and I so that I can perhaps nudge you in favor of answering this prayer request of mine. Here's what it looks like for us. We say things like this. Lord, I'm in a bind. I promise you, Lord, if you get me out of this bind, I vow to you, I promise to you that my church attendance is going to be perfect for 7 years. And what we're doing is we're seeking to get the credit for that in advance so that we can bargain with the Lord, get his deliverance in the moment. And then the issue is if the Lord does answer that prayer, now we've got to carry through. I can't believe that people actually do these sorts of things with the Lord still. With all the knowledge that we have of the Word of God, and yet people are still making vows, trying to get credit with the Lord in advance, trying to leverage that to strike a deal with the Lord. News alert, Anchored Fellowship, God does not play that game. I know many Christians think he does, but God does not play that game. They think God is up there like, okay, let's see, you said 7 years, 7 years, perfect attendance at the fellowship. It's pretty good. Tell you what, throw in tithing and you got a deal. God doesn't need to haggle concerning the responding to the prayer requests that you bring before him. The Lord has already settled these issues. Here's the way that it works with the Lord. Here's his approach. If you are his child, you can ask of him whatever you will, even on your worst day. And if it is the Lord's will for you, then he will do it. That's how this works. We don't have to convince God. He's already convinced about us. So this is all just a matter of our human emotions getting in the way. Here's the emotion. It's the feeling that we are simply not worthy of asking the thing that we want to ask the Lord. That's what it is. That's our emotion. Lord, I had a less than stellar week. I just don't feel right about asking you for this miracle, but I need a miracle. So I need to borrow from future credit. Lord, here's what I'll commit. Here's what I'll do in the future. Here's what I'll do different if you'll come through on this. You know why we do that? We do that, I think, first and foremost, to make ourselves feel better about how unworthy we feel to ask the Lord of anything. And maybe a little bit we do it to kind of convince the Lord to feel better about answering our request. But as Christians, this is a part of life, knowing that we are unworthy. There's not a single blessing that the Lord has given to us, from salvation to the answering of the most simple prayer request. There's not a single blessing that the Lord has given to us that we have actually deserved. So this is part of life for the Christian. It's just getting used to the fact that we know we're unworthy, but that our Father has told us that we can ask him anyway, knowing that everything he gives us, we are unworthy of. There's not a single thing that the Lord gives to us to where we can say, okay, Lord, now we're even. I deserve that. Thank you for paying up. Now we're squared. There's not a thing that the Lord gives us that we can say that. Listen to Romans chapter 8, verse 32. Paul says, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously not deservedly, but graciously give us all things. So you see the point of the verse there. That's a good verse to always keep before you. I think you're going to need it plenty. It's your reminder that God is already convinced about you. He doesn't need to be convinced to answer your prayer requests. He was already convinced enough about you to give His very best, the Son of God, on the cross. And if He did that for you, well, then He's also convinced that if you ask Him in your unworthy state, He still has the heart. Despite the fact that you don't deserve it, He still has the heart to meet your needs because He loves you. Now, just to be clear, it is not that Jephthah has sinned by wanting to take a vow before the Lord. And when a person desires to take a vow or even takes a vow, there's nothing sinful about that. I'm not saying that it is patently wrong or anything like that. God actually wrote laws about vows in the Old Testament law, which means He has given His people permission to make vows. However, there is that stipulation that when we are making a vow, it should be free will, not coerced, free will, and there should be no strings attached. It should be for the purpose of blessing the Lord. Here, Lord, I'm doing this, I'm making this vow just to bless You. And so that's where we have a problem with Jephthah's vow. Jephthah's is not a no-strings-attached vow. He gives the Lord here an if-then statement. You know what that means if you're a computer coder? Do you know what that means in the Bible? It means we have a dependent portion of sentence here. Lord, if You'll do Your part, then I'll do my part. What I'm doing, Lord, is I'm trying to sweeten the pot. I'm trying to cut a deal here. And that is nothing more than being weak in the faith and weak in your understanding of the grace of God. So that's Jephthah's issue. I can guarantee you that. That's his issue. Now, we're not hard on Jephthah. We don't fault him too much because he's an Old Testament saint. He has lesser light than you and I do. But because we have greater light in the New Testament era, we need to make sure that we do at least point out the fault here in the vow so that we aren't tempted to make the same mistake. We ought to do much better as New Testament Christians. Verse 32. So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand, verse 33, and he struck them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Keramim, so that's all within about a 10-mile radius. With a great blow, the scripture says, so the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel, .. It wasn't even close. How do I know that? I know this had to be a huge thing. This had to be a big battle against all odds because Jephthah's name is included in the Hall of Faith chapter, as I said last week, Hebrews chapter 11. And I know that this wasn't even close because God was involved in this battle. And when the Lord is in the fight, there is only one way for the Lord to win, and that is decisively. Don't you love that about the Lord? You're on His side, and He never just like barely squeaks out a victory. I mean, he may make you sweat on the timing, but He's never going to just barely win. I know some people think that there's this cosmic battle between God and Satan, and it gets awfully close at times. And you have to really pull for the Lord and cheer Him over the top so that He can win. Look, it's not even close. When the Lord is in a fight, there's only one way for Him to win, and that is decisively. So this is a decisive victory. So decisive, in fact, that you won't hear a peep from the Ammonites for about 50 years. We're not going to read about them being an issue, a problem for the nation of Israel, until we get to 1 Samuel chapter 11. So this really has taken care of the Ammonites for a long time to come. Remember in chapter 10, we were told that it was the Ammonites and the Philistines during the era of Jephthah that had risen up and conquered and then oppressed the nation of Israel. Well, here you go. Jephthah, the Lord through Jephthah, has taken care of the Ammonites. And the Lord's got one more group of people on His hit list here. Who is it? It's the Philistines. And who's going to be raised up to take care of the Philistines? It's going to be our man, Samson. And it's real easy to remember that we're going to start studying him in chapter 13 because he is the 13th judge, if you count Barak. And his story begins in the 13th chapter. But back to our story here, it's a little anticlimactic, don't you think? We've had this buildup for the battle for the whole chapter. We've been moving this way, this big showdown. And then the Lord, in a very vague two-verse description, gives us the account of the battle and the victory for the nation of Israel. A little bit anticlimactic. Like, I want to read, how did it happen? Where did the troops position? Who went first? Who did what? You know, give me some story. Give me some heroic telling here. But if you're like me, I got to admit, I'm okay with a short description here. Because once we hit verse 30, I don't know about you, but I want to finish that story up. When we opened up that can of worms about Jephthah's vow, I really want to know what happened with that vow. What's going on? And that's exactly what the Lord gives us next. He gets to it very quickly here in chapter 11. And beginning in verse 34, we get down to the bottom of this vow that Jephthah made. Let's read. Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah. He has returned victoriously from battle. And behold, his daughter came out to meet him. Now you remember the vow. We read it tonight again. The vow was, Lord, anything that comes out my door, the moment I get home, the first thing that steps out of that door, I am going to slaughter that thing and offer it up to you as a burnt offering. And so upon getting home, it is his daughter that is the first to step out of his home. So what now? Promised a burnt sacrifice. Here's his daughter now. What in the world? Well, hang on to that for just a moment. Let's keep reading. His daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. She was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. This is all sounding pretty serious, isn't it? Like, this is a very serious setup. Your heart is starting to break for Jephthah and his daughter here because things aren't looking good. We know what Jephthah vowed, and here comes his daughter out the door, banging her tambourine, celebrating what wonderful things the Lord has done through her father. And obviously she has heard the news of the victory, and she's just, she's out there to celebrate her dad. And the scripture's getting real intense on us. It's telling us, she was the only kid. And the verses are making us nervous. Is this guy actually going to do what we think it sounds like he's going to do? Oh, and there she is, you know. What a moment. Ordinarily, it'd be quite a special moment. I remember moments like this. When my kids were just itty-bitty, it happened every weekday of my life when I would come home from work. I mean, before I could, they would hear the vehicle coming. They'd know that I was home, and before I could get into the front door, man, they'd beat me to it, and they'd just gang-hug me, grab onto me, and give me love yous and miss yous and all that, and just special moments, moments you'll remember forever. It's the kind of moment this would have been, except for the fact that on this day, Jephthah, he is going to be very heavy-hearted because his daughter, she's no kiddo. She is of marrying age. That is Jephthah's only child. You read it right there in the passage. It's not just his only daughter. This is his only child. So this is his chance at furthering his name. This is his chance at grandkids. And unfortunately, she's the first out the door. What now? And why would this guy do that? I heard someone suggest that probably his mother-in-law was always over and he was hoping she'd be the first one to come out. I didn't say that. Don't get mad at me. I'm just telling you someone else said that. Personally, I love my mother-in-law very much, but I doubt that's it. No, there actually is an explanation for this. And anyone that has pets will understand this. If you have pets and that door opens, you are not the first one out that door. Your pet is the first one out that door. If you have a border collie, that dog might not even wait for the door to open. He might just, you know, charge it before you can even get the screen door open. For that purpose, me and Maggie have a shed filled with replacement screen doors so that when that happens, we don't really have that. We probably should, but we don't. Yeah, you know how this is. You open the door, and it is the dog that runs out the door first. It's the pet that runs out the door first. Now, I know that is not exactly the same for the Jewish culture. They didn't have dogs and cats, but they did keep clean animals, sacrificial animals, animals like sheep, in their homes as pets. That was a pretty common thing. So what I'm telling you is that I believe completely here that Jephthah was expecting one of his pet lambs to run out the front door when he came home. And because it was a pet, it would have been a pretty serious sacrifice for Jephthah. That's what he was expecting to come out the door. Not a person. How do I know I'm right about this? Well, you can just look at the text and it'll prove me right, because the text does not say that whoever comes out the door first, but the text says whatever comes out the door first. He is definitely not expecting a person to come out the door first, not even his mother-in-law. Guaranteed. Okay, but we're still back to the same problem. His daughter is the one that came out the door first. What now? I'll hold that thought a little longer. Verse 35. If you haven't caught on yet, I'm going to make you hold that thought until we finish reading all of our verses. Verse 35. And as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you have become the cause of great trouble to me, for I have opened my mouth, my big old mouth, to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow." And again, we're like, what is happening here? The vow is to offer up a burnt offering. Do you see how the scriptures keep pushing us toward this conclusion? They hook us and they drag us along thinking that he's actually going to offer up his daughter as a sacrifice. We come to verse 35 and he says, "Oh, well, I shot my mouth off. I got to do it now. Sorry, I made a vow." Burnt offering, first thing that comes out the door. You were the first thing. But surely this guy isn't going to do that, right? Well, hold that thought. Verse 36. And she said to him, "My father, you have opened your mouth, your big old mouth, to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth. Now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites." Verse 37. So she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. I only have one request here, Dad. Leave me alone for 2 months." Sounds like she's mad, but she's not. There's more to it. "Leave me alone for 2 months, that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity, I and my companions." Okay, so this story, it's the story that keeps on complexing. Like the story that keeps on giving, this is the story that keeps on complexing. It just keeps getting more and more complexing. What in the world does virginity have to do with any of this? Where did that come from? Is she saying, "Dad, give me some time to make my peace with this. I'm going to be a burnt offering. And I'm going to die a virgin. I'm never going to get a chance to marry." Is that what she's saying? Well, hold on to that thought too. But first, before we move on and read verse 38, I want you to focus for just a moment on this young lady's heart for the Lord. Isn't this a refreshing thing to see? When she could have been stubborn about her quote-unquote rights, or she could have brought up her feelings. She could have resisted and said, you know, what you said to the Lord, that's not my problem. I didn't have anything to do with that. Why would you commit me to something like that? But instead of all of that, she just is absolutely willing to carry out this vow. And we haven't determined what that's going to be yet, but whatever is going to be included in this vow here, his daughter is willing. She wants to bless the Lord. She wants to bless her dad. So I just look at this guy Jephthah and I say, man, I think this guy did something right in the way that he raised his daughter. And I think the Lord gave him a daughter that had a very soft heart to him. It's refreshing anytime we get to see this, people putting the Lord above their rights and their feelings. Because in Jephthah's daughter's case, she was living in a time period where we're told over and again that people did what was right in their own eyes. We call that humanism and hedonism. And as you know, that's the rule of the day for the most part, by and large, in this country. America has become largely humanistic and hedonistic. It's kind of like this. I got to speak my truth. I got to be good to me. I got to do what feels right. I got to find my own way. I got to follow my own heart. That's kind of the rule of the day in the everyday American that is not deeply devoted to Christ. And we've almost got to the point where you have to read the Bible to see something like this. A heart that puts the Lord before all of that other stuff. A heart that's completely selfless and has loves in their life greater than the love that they have for themselves. You certainly don't see it out there very much. And if we're being honest, sometimes it can even be tough to find among Christians. Sometimes even Christians can be very selfish in the way that they live their lives. Almost borderline humanistic and hedonistic at times. So I just love and thank you for giving me these few moments here. You'd have had to interrupt the teaching to stop me, but you could have. So thank you for giving me these few moments here just to take that pause and reflect on the beauty of this young lady's heart toward her heavenly father and her earthly father. It's so inspiring and such a refreshing thing to be thinking about as we read here. Verse 38, so he said, go. He's granting her that one last request that she had. Go, he says. Then he sent her away for 2 months, and she departed, she and her companions, and wept for her virginity on the mountains. Okay, keep that tucked away in the back of your mind. Verse 39. And at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. She had never known a man, and it became a custom in Israel, verse 40, that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in the year. Okay, now, confusing as that may be, we now have all of the pieces. So let's pick up all of these pieces and let's put it all together. Again, as I suggested, the passage seems to be pointing us to the fact that Jephthah's daughter was to be put to death as a burnt sacrifice before the Lord. You get kind of the overtones of tragedy here as you're reading. And then, of course, the word lament, that doesn't help much. And here's where we need to ignore where we think the passage is taking us and actually fall back on the Old Testament knowledge that we do have concerning the sacrificial system that was given in the law of Moses. To cut right to the chase on this, we are told straight up what this vow was. Just look back at verse 39 again. Maybe you caught it the first time through. Verse 39 says this, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. And here's what that looked like. She had never known a man. All right, did it click? Everyone got it? Does everyone know what that vow looked like? Very clearly here, the vow of Jephthah was that his daughter would never marry and never know a man sexually. That was the vow. That's what his daughter went to mourn for 2 months. This is very consistent in the passage. There's actually nothing else supported here. His daughter went to mourn her virginity for 2 months. She didn't go to mourn the fact that she was going to lose her life. She went to mourn her virginity. The keeping of her virginity. And that's what the daughters of Jephthah went to weep over 4 days out of every year. My guess would be that it became sort of like an annual single ladies event. You know, you go there to Mizpah for 4 days. Maybe they have like conferences and stuff. And you go there to lament over your singleness and pray, Lord, please don't let the fate of Jephthah's daughter be my fate. Lord, please bring me a husband. I suppose it could be the other way around, too. I suppose this could have been a conference yearly for the married ladies who came to lament that they weren't blessed with singleness as Jephthah's daughter was. Lord, you gave me this man. Now I'm stuck. I guess that's up for interpretation. Could go either way, I suppose. No. But for sure, they were weeping over Jephthah's daughter's vow of celibacy. That's what this is. It's a vow of celibacy. And I need you to know that. It's very important to me that you don't leave here tonight not knowing that to be the truth as given to us in the Scriptures. Because there are a lot of misconceptions about what exactly took place here and what exactly Jephthah did to his daughter when he carried out this vow. There are many who either don't have the Old Testament knowledge of the sacrificial system to know better. There are some that just forget what they know about the Old Testament law. And they get drug into the story and they get tricked by the flow and the feel of it. And they make a wrong assumption about the outcome of it. I'll be honest, there are even very reputable commentators who think that this was actually about human sacrifice. And they'll say that right in their commentaries. That's what they think Jephthah did, that he offered up his daughter as a human sacrifice. I know that that's a conception, at least partially, in this fellowship, because I had someone come up to me after last week's study and say, oh boy, I forgot about what Jephthah did. Oh my, what a shame. What a shame. And I could tell by the way that person was saying that, that they thought Jephthah had offered up his daughter as a human sacrifice. That's not true. Everyone with me on that? All right, let me just give you some. I know it seems like, oh wow, we're going to be done early tonight because he's done reading verses and it's only 7:20. Well, we may be done early tonight, Lord willing, but let me just reinforce this biblically with you so that there are no misconceptions about this in the future. When you hear someone like wacky enough in the future to say, man, I can't believe Jephthah offered up his daughter as a human sacrifice, I want to make sure you don't think, oh, is that what happened? No, I don't want you to even go there for a minute. We start by knowing what a burnt sacrifice or a burnt offering was. And to get that information, we go back to Leviticus chapter 1. That's where the Lord gives us those five offerings that were part of the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. The first one it gives to us is the burnt offering. We know what it symbolizes. We studied it a lot here in this fellowship. Remember, we kept going over it and over and over it because we were going through Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. Well, a burnt offering is a sign of consecration or dedication to the Lord. And there were let me reword that. There was a very small list of acceptable animal sacrifices when it came to a burnt offering. Here's what you were allowed. You were allowed to bring a bull. Not a cow, a bull. You were allowed to bring a sheep Or if you were a little bit lower in the income bracket, then you could bring two turtle doves. Those were your options. Those were the only sacrifices, those were the only burnt offerings that the Lord would accept. So there is no way that Jephthah is trying to bring his daughter to the priests and have his daughter offered up as a human sacrifice. It would never happen in Israel. I mean, as twisted and messed up as they are, during the period of the judges, they're not this messed up. Never would there be human sacrifices in the history of the nation of Israel, all the more so upon God's altar in the tabernacle. Jephthah tried to pull something like this off. The priest would stop him at the gate and say, "What in the world do you think you're doing?" And probably whoop on him a little bit and kick him out. There's no way that this would ever happen in the tabernacle. Secondly, the whole point of a burnt offering was to serve as a substitutionary consecration of an individual. I don't know if this is going to come flooding back to your memory or not. Leviticus 1 was a long time ago for us here on Wednesday nights. But the whole reason that this consecration or burnt offering existed was because there was only one group of people that could actually consecrate or dedicate their whole life to the Lord by lifelong service for Yahweh. Only one group of people, and that was the Levites. They were the only ones that could do that. But the Lord saw the desire in the hearts of his people that weren't Levites to want to be dedicated and consecrated to him. And so he came up with this offering, this substitutionary consecration or credited consecration. And here's the way it worked. You would bring your animal, a bull, a sheep, or two turtle dove. You'd bring that to the priest and you'd say, "I want to offer my life up to the Lord. I want to be consecrated, completely, wholly dedicated to God. But I'm not from the tribe of Levi. So I can't do that practically and realistically. So here's my offering of consecration." And the way this worked is that bull or that sheep or those two turtle doves would accomplish what the person couldn't. That animal in your place would be wholly consecrated to God. And I mean wholly. It would be completely consumed by the fire on the altar. So that animal was going the last full measure, giving it all to the Lord, being consumed on the altar of service. Something you couldn't do. But after you gave that offering, you walked away with that substitutionary consecration. It was the Lord's way of saying, "I accept that, and I credit you as being consecrated to me because of your proxy. That animal paid the price. You get the credit for it. You get the substitutionary consecration. Your life doesn't change a bit. Didn't cost you anything more than a bull, a sheep, or two turtle doves. And yet, though your life doesn't change in God's eyes, it does. You're credited with consecration before the Lord." We really should not have been surprised to come to the New Testament and read about the substitutionary work of Christ on our behalf because of our faith, free from charge to us. It should not have surprised us to read about credited righteousness and credited consecration and gifted salvation, because those weren't concepts that began at Christ. He didn't introduce those. The substitutionary work. That was mapped out in the Old Testament law. That all of that, the whole concept of substitutionary and credited and free of charge, that was all built right into the law, patterned out for us, and then fleshed out for us ultimately in the person of Christ. Now, according to the law, This is what this should have looked like for Jephthah and his daughter. You know, he may have had a sheep in mind. I wouldn't think turtle doves. Who knows? You know, maybe the guy had turtle doves free in his house. Whatever. Doubt he had a bull in there. But if he had an animal in mind, okay, then the vow meant one thing until a human being walked out that front door. And now a vow meant something else. Here's the way that it should have naturally worked for Jephthah. When Jephthah saw that it was his daughter that came out, first of all, he could have done this. He could have said, okay, well, obviously we don't sacrifice human beings in the nation of Israel, so I'll just wait for the first animal to come out. Whatever that animal is, I'll offer that up as a burnt offering. I think that's personally what he should have done. That's what he promised the Lord. That's what he would have been giving the Lord. The second thing that would have been expected is if he decided to say, okay, well, my daughter was the first one out, so I don't want to back off of this at all. I want to offer my daughter as a consecration, a burnt offering to the Lord. So how would that work? Just the way we read about it in Leviticus chapter 1, if you are not from the tribe of Levi. Here's how he would have offered his daughter as a burnt offering. He would have brought a bull or a lamb or two turtle doves. He would have offered them up in her place. The animal dies. She gets the credited consecration. And then her life doesn't change except for her status as consecrated before God. So that was one out here. Well, technically, I've given you two things he could have done already to get out of anything further or deeper than that. Here's another one. Here's a third out that Jephthah could have taken. This was written right into the law that in lieu of a burnt offering, the law of Moses allowed you to pay the equivalent fee for a burnt offering, and you received the benefit of the same thing. So you were saying, all right, and, you know, I want to do a burnt offering. I'm a little low on bulls this month, and that's no bull. It's been a tight month. So I don't want to bring an animal. Here's what I want to do. I just want to pay for it. I want to pay for consecration. Well, you could give your money straight to the tabernacle. It would go right to the work of the Lord. And you would get the blessing of credited or substitutionary consecration. So he could have done that. He could have paid this off. But it's pretty obvious that none of that sat right in the conscience of Jephthah. He decides, I don't want to back off this even a little bit. I have legitimate outs according to the law of Moses. I wouldn't be breaking my word to the Lord at all. But you know how this is. Sometimes you could get off on a technicality, but your conscience doesn't let you feel right about that. You ever been in that situation? Well, I could do this or I could say this because it's technically true. Well, yeah, but is that really conveying the right message? Is that really doing the right thing? Does that really sit well with my conscience? And when the answer is no, you don't back off. You don't take the easy way out. Jephthah says, I can't do it. I can't take the easy way out. I've consecrated the first thing. She was the first thing. Obviously, I'm not going to offer her up as a burnt offering, but I've got to find something that equates to a burnt offering. Now, think about it. If you're a woman, let's see, not from the tribe of Levi, how could you do this? How could you take a vow and dedicate your whole life only to the Lord? You could take a vow of celibacy. And this has to be part of the unwritten conversation that took place between him and his daughter. He had to have this talk with his daughter. Honey, I vowed a burnt offering for the first thing. You were the first thing. And here's what I'm thinking that looks like to me. I'm thinking that I would offer you up as a daughter that takes a vow of celibacy before the Lord and commits her whole life wholeheartedly, body, soul, mind, spirit, all of it to God and God alone. And they obviously had that conversation. And she was willing. She was willing. She was willing to say, I love the Lord and I love you enough that I'm willing to take this vow of celibacy. Essentially, he's asking her to be a nun, you know. He's asking her to be a nun, and she is willing. That is the interpretation. That is completely supported by the text that we just read tonight, Judges chapter 11, and the Old Testament law of Moses, the sacrificial system. The interpretation that this was a human sacrifice, man, that is so far out in left field. Even though it can sound like that and feel like that at times as you're reading it, that is so far out in left field. That is so far off center from the Word of God. There's no support for that, not only in the law of Moses, but nowhere else in the Word of God, and certainly not in Judges chapter 11. So, what was the vow? Celibacy.